Beak, nest, wind, dreams. Sometimes when we look at words, we find they are knots, planets, eyelids. As a child, my father used to call me his puce. Arriving home from work, he would pick me up. Salut ma puce, ça va? Recently, I learnt this word means flea. It's a common term of endearment in French, often for small children. However, puce is also a colour, a deep, dark, brownish red. The word was assigned to it precisely because of the way the translucent belly of a flea looks when engorged and darkened with blood. The seededness of such a word fills his absence, yields new analyses. I was his flea, his blood-filled flea, his tiny parasite. An invisible yet stubborn thread binds him to this carrier of his DNA. These days we try to locate it, sew delicate stitches every few years, make a small mending. I was too young to have children, he offers, as we sit eating peanuts in his apartment. His mother, Thérèse Revuelta, née de Burin, whittles away her late 90s in a small town beside the Rhône River in France. I go to stay with her for a week in the middle of winter, having seen her just once since I was 3 years old. She is partially deaf, doesn't speak any English, and I don't speak any French. We are kept shut in by dark skies, a tall wooden fence, and fierce wind. Trump has been elected the week before I come, and the newspapers arrive at her door each morning, their outrage muffled by our isolation. She flicks through the pages, routinely scanning the obituaries at the back for her own name, finally shrugging and exclaiming a phrase translated by her carer as, "Not me today." One day, she opens a closet for me that is filled with the clothes of her late husband, my grandfather, Adrien, who died the year before. So, still alive. And so, henceforth, another cup of instant coffee and toast, another bath, clothes put on, cooked lunch, another long afternoon nap while I go out walking. We don't know what to do with each other. We sit together at her table eating overripe bananas, peeled grapes, carefully de-pithed segments of mandarins, the refrigerator humming. She examines my hands and hers. One night I am searching for a bowl in her kitchen and she asks what I am looking for. I remember its French word sounds similar, and so we go back and forth, repeating variations on the word bowl. Un bowl, I say. She frowns. Bowl? I try again. Bowl, un bowl? I tap the fruit bowl on the table. Ah, un bowl, she says, taking my hands again. We do what we can with such frayed rope, talking to each other in our own languages, staring into the other's face in the hopes it will show us some sort of comprehension, echoing each other's words aloud as though it might make them mean something. We break our languages into pieces for each other the way mothers do with food. There is a sense that, in the silence of words intercepted and gutted, something has also wriggled free. What is it, this breaking, this piecing? Think of an inscription cut in stone. Would you say words are the cuts in the stone, or words are the stone around the cuts? Anne Carson. One afternoon, my grandmother's carer, Sylvie, perhaps the most benevolent soul I've ever come across, takes me to see the ruins of an old castle. We go there in the morning after an 11 a.m. bourbon and coke. It is up high on a mountain. The castle had many rooms once, but only their walls and windows are still standing in the grass. There are blocks of limestone lying everywhere, sunken into the earth. They once formed ceilings, but are now reduced back down to their individual pieces. There are birds flying below in the valley. During our walk through the ruins, Sylvie teaches me four French words. Bec, beak, nid, nest, vent, wind, and live dreams. I collect them together like a handful of pebbles, picked to form a loose map of the things we come across. Francis Ponge says a pebble is a stage of stone between rock and gravel. It is stone precisely at the stage when it becomes a person, an individual. In other words, the stage of speech. I help my grandmother put on her hearing aid, sliding its plastic into place around the sculpted cartilage of her ear like a big paper clip. Through my laptop speakers, I play her Gustav Mahler, Edith Piaf, Charles Trenet. She smiles vaguely, perhaps bored. I can't make it out. We close the shutters together over the window as it gets dark. Pira was one of the only survivors after an enormous flood wiped out all of her people. She went to ask the oracle, "How can I rebuild the population?" To which the oracle replied, "You must gather the bones of your mother and throw them behind you, over your shoulder." Pira was devastated. How could she exhume her own mother's remains? She firmly refused. And yet she thought more about the oracle's words. Perhaps mother could be interpreted as earth. Perhaps bones, in this case, meant something else too. Stones. She gathered a pile of stones with her hands, picked them up, threw them behind her. Their moist moss became flesh, their veins filled with blood, their solid cores became bone. They grew faces and hair, arms, legs. What symmetry there is in this. Bones transforming into stones, semantically, then becoming bones again, physically. Human becoming earth, becoming human. Words open and close and open, breathing through their sutures.